Welcome to the Modern Federalist. Your compass in the world of politics, policy, and people. We're here to challenge norms, question narratives, and offer balanced insight on pressing issues. Your host, Charlton Allen, is a seasoned analyst and a staunch advocate for freedom. With his sharp intellect, he'll guide you through the maze of contemporary politics. Whether you're a political enthusiast or just a curious observer, you've found your haven. This is the Modern Federalist. Welcome to the revolution.
Ladies and gentlemen, fellow guardians of liberty, welcome aboard the Modern Federalist Podcast. I'm Charlton Allen, and I'm your captain today, and we're charting a course through tempest and triumphs. Batten down the hatches, our ship sails into uncharted waters. First on the agenda is the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore. A recent incident, the bridge's collapse, shakes our foundations. Evidence? It's not yet conclusive. But regardless, we awaken. For beyond accidents lie adversaries, those who wish us harm. They watch, they probe. Our resilience, their calculus. Next, we'll discuss a recent protest at the University of Michigan. Pro-Palestinian demonstrators hijacked an honors convocation. Rudeness? Check. Misapplied First Amendment? Double check. And folks, I have to admit, I'm tired. I'm tired of the virulent anti-Semitism. I'm tired of the mind-numbing slogans. Hey, hey, ho, ho, your stupid slogan has got to go. No more heckler's veto. Our free speech sails on. Then we'll set sail for an interview with Diana Furtgut-Roth of the Heritage Foundation. We're diving into the choppy seas of banning Chinese electric vehicles, EVs, in a more general discussion of some of the issues with EVs. It's not just tariffs. It's legacy, stewardship, and freedom. And speaking of transport, we're taking on the DC Purple Line, a transit saga that deserves our scrutiny. Mark Joffe at the Cato Institute sounds the alarm. Let's dissect this rail riddle. As we wrap up, imagine Fort McHenry, our flag defiant against bombardment. Our banner endures. Our way of life, a beacon for the world. So, fellow patriots, let's keep our compass true. We'll throw in some parody, crank up the music, and remember, liberty's shores await. This is the Modern Federalist Podcast, where ideas collide, liberty thrives, and that storm, we'll sail through it. Second star to the right, and straight on until morning. Leading off the program today, I wanted to delve into a story ripped from our nation's headlines, a tale that is reverberating around our land, leaving echoes of tragedy and questions in its wake. As we gather around the digital hearth, let us remember that while we dissect the economic and security implications, our nation also grieves. We grieve for those who were lost, for lives unalterably changed, for beneath the cold calculus of numbers lies the heartbeat of humanity. On the fateful night of March 26, the 984-foot-long container ship Dali, sailing under the flag of Singapore, set forth from the port of Baltimore. But destiny, unfortunately, had other plans. At approximately 1:30 a.m. Eastern Time, the Dali collided with one of the pillars beneath the Francis Scott Key Bridge, triggering a cataclysmic collapse. The bridge, once a lifeline, now lies submerged, a testament to the vulnerability and interconnectedness of our transportation system. Now let's peel back the layers. Was this a terrorist act? The legacy media hesitates, but we know better. Whether lone wolves or orchestrated foes, the eyes are upon us. Fragile and interconnected, our transport and trade systems quiver. Economic and national security concerns converge. The Biden administration faces a crucible, a test of mettle and agility. And here's the truth. Even if this were not an act of terror, bad actors watch and take notes. The incident in Baltimore reveals how fragile our systems are, how a single collision could ripple through our economy and our nation's security. It's a critical moment, and the early returns are not positive. Transportation Secretary Buttigieg's Jim Crack response at his recent press conference only reinforces the notion that he is in over his head. The Port of Baltimore isn't just a harbor, it's an economic artery. ranked ninth largest in the United States, it pulses with cargo, dollars, and destiny. But now it gasps for breath, caught in the undertow of uncertainty. As the sun rises over the wreckage, may our resolve rise with it. Let us be the modern defenders of our nation, vigilant and unwavering. For just as Fort McHenry stood firm, so shall we. And so with somber resolve, let us navigate the currents of uncertainty. For just as our nation's bridges span rivers, so do they connect our past, present, and future. As we mourn, let us seek answers, demand accountability, and honor those whose paths were forever altered. And for Secretary Buttigieg and the Biden administration as a whole, now is the time the American people deserve answers and also resolve to protect our security, leveraging resources with unwavering vigor. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Modern Federalist Podcast. I'm your host, Charlton Allen, and today we're diving headfirst into a topic that has been making waves on college campuses across the nation, pro-Palestinian protest. We've discussed this before, but today we will dissect the recent incident at the University of Michigan, where a group of students disrupted an honors convocation. Buckle up, because this one's a doozy. Picture this, a sun-drenched quad. Well, that's a stretch. We're talking about Michigan in the winter. There is nothing sun-drenched about Michigan in the winter. It's just cold. But in any event, proud parents and graduates beaming in their caps and gowns. It's the University of Michigan's honor convocation, a celebration of academic achievement, Wolverine spirit, and the culmination of years of hard work. But wait, what's that sound in the distance? It's a group of protesters chanting slogans and waving banners. Yes, the discordant sound of disruption. Now, about these protest chants, I'm not going to dignify these by repeating the words, but you know what I am talking about. These chants sprout up like dandelions after a late-night brainstorming session, fueled by too much coffee, or perhaps a more questionable brew. Natty light. The rhyming convention is a poetic potluck. The chants are not an iambic pentameter, and no one would ever confuse them for that. But in Dr. Seuss meets tipsy karaoke form. They're somewhat catchy, like bubblegum stuck to your cerebral cortex. They'll never be mistaken for a Shakespearean sonnet, but they do stick. And sometimes that's all the leftist protesters need, a jingle to jangle hearts for the news cycle. But friends, beware. These chants shapeshift. They amplify half-truths, outright falsehoods, and misdirect blame. Nuance? It packs its bags and leaves. These progressives will recite their not-so-creative chant, careful to insert whichever cause they have on their heart in its midst, and hope we all fall for it. My warning is simply put, don't. But back to the scene at the University of Michigan. The pro-Palestinian protesters decided this joyous occasion, the honors convocation, was the perfect time to air their various and sundry grievances. They barged in like party crashers at a wedding, demanding that the university divest from companies associated with Israel, shouting down the president of the university. Because nothing says congratulations, graduates, quite like a heated debate about geopolitical conflicts. Now let's address the elephant in the room, the heckler's veto. You see, no group, whether it's pro-Palestinian, pro-Israel, or pro-unicorn, should have the power to hijack an event. Freedom of speech doesn't mean freedom to shout down others. It doesn't mean disrupting a ceremony that's meant to celebrate academic excellence. It's like crashing a birthday party and insisting that everyone discuss your favorite conspiracy theory. It's just not cool, folks. But wait, there's more. Disrupting an honors convocation isn't just a matter of free speech. It's downright disrespectful. Imagine parents who traveled miles to see their child walk across that stage. And imagine the professors who worked tirelessly to mentor, or more likely brainwash, these students. But I digress. And now imagine it's all cut short because of a chant and a handful of banners. It's like showing up at the convocation wearing a Buckeye jersey and performing a kazoo solo. Let's celebrate free speech, but also recognize that doesn't grant anyone a license to disrupt, to stifle, or to hijack. And as for that rhyming chant, leftists do better. Maybe next time you can add a verse about finding a more productive and creative way to express your views. Until then, remember folks, disruptive behavior, whether in rhyme or not, doesn't make you a hero. It just makes you a nuisance. Thank you for listening, and may your convocations be heckler-free.
Ladies and gentlemen, fasten your tricorn hats. Our voyage through politics today continues. Liberty awaits. This is The Modern Federalist.
Welcome back to The Modern Federalist Podcast, where we dig deep into the policy corral and wrangle ideas like seasoned cowpokes. I'm your host, Charlton Allen, and today we have a trailblazing guest who knows her way around the economic range. She's an Oxford-educated economist with over 30 years of executive-level policy experience. She served alongside Presidents Reagan, Bush 41, and Bush 43, and she's no stranger to the TV and radio circuit. You might have read her columns in Forbes or caught her insights on the airwaves. Buckle up, folks, because today we're talking about a hot, indeed a charged topic, banning Chinese electric vehicles. Please welcome to the show the Herbert and Joyce Morgan Fellow in Energy and Environmental Policy at the Heritage Foundation, Diana Furtgott-Ruth. Director Furtgott-Ruth, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Charlton, and please call me Diana.
I will. In your recent article, you argue that America should ban Chinese electric vehicles. Could you elaborate more on the main reasons behind that stance?
Of course, Charlton. It's very important, and there are three main reasons. Briefly, the three are threats of spying, disabling the vehicles, and undercutting U.S. EV incentives. Which one would you like me to start with first?
Let's start with the spying component.
Well, Americans can relate to the spying component because everyone was so concerned last summer when a Chinese spy balloon was going overhead. And it went from Alaska all the way to the coast of South Carolina, Myrtle Beach, where it was shot down and examined. But Chinese EVs can be equipped with even more powerful spying equipment, and they're going around other people's streets in other countries, and they could be going around American streets if we permitted them and allowed them to be in. These EVs are basically computers on wheels. And what they can do is pick up information about utilities, military bases, people's identities, social security numbers, and send that back to China. And that's very detailed information that Americans do not want the Chinese to have. And there's a major reason for banning Chinese EVs, national security grounds. And just as Huawei was banned on telecommunications equipment and ZTE, we should also ban Chinese EVs on these same grounds. Is that clear, Charlton?
I think that's clear. I wanted to follow up a bit on that point. I recall recently former CIA Director Leon Panetta testified before the House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party building a Chinese plant in Michigan and the dangers inherent with that. And also, I recall seeing that Ford is using a Chinese military software supplier for an EV factory in the United States. So if I am correct, based upon what I've seen in my own research, this threat is not just isolated to Chinese-built EVs. It can also become endemic in vehicles with badges of a domestic manufacturer that utilizes Chinese components in the computer and circuitry. Is that correct?
Well, I think that's partly correct, but a battery in itself cannot send back as much information to China as an entire EV, because an entire EV contains a lot of telematic information that can send a lot more data back than just a battery. China makes 80% of the world's batteries, and that's why the U.S. government has tax incentives for battery factories here. And the factory that we were talking about, CATL, that Ford was partnering with in Michigan, Ford has now placed a pause on that battery. And the plant was originally also considered for Virginia, and Governor Youngkin made a lot of waves when he said no, Virginia would not have the CATL plant because he didn't think that CATL was a good partner for Ford and should be in Virginia.
Thank you for that information. I want to dive into the component issue a little bit with how the Chinese government could, in a time of conflict with the United States, basically shut down and shut off all EVs that are manufactured there. Chevrolet, as I understand it, had similar technology in their electronic vehicles, and that in and of itself is problematic. But if that were under the control of the Chinese Communist Party, that raises significant concerns that on the national security front and our ability to maintain economic viability.
Exactly. Well, just as GM's OnStar program advertises that it can stop or disable stolen vehicles, any auto manufacturer, not just an electric vehicle manufacturer, can stop or disable the car from remote. So if you have a GM vehicle and you subscribe to OnStar, then when you report the vehicle stolen, GM advertises that it can slow the vehicle and stop the vehicle. So this technology already exists. And if GM has it, I'm sure that Ford has it and Stellantis and other major auto companies have it. The question before us is, do we want Chinese companies to have it? Do we want the Chinese Communist Party to be able to stop or disable vehicles just driving around America's roads? And I would argue that the answer is no, that we want to prevent these vehicles coming into the country and not give the Chinese Communist Party power over American drivers, because we have to make a difference in between trade with China and trade with other countries, because China has said all along that it's not friendly to the United States. And China in other countries tried to undercut their car manufacturer. We find that U.S. companies operating in China right now, where they were lured for a share of the Chinese market, that their sales have been declining and sales of Chinese companies have been increasing. So sales of companies such as BYD, Great Wall, and other such companies have been increasing, whereas sales of GM and Ford cars have been declining. Similarly, Chinese car companies have been undercutting European manufacturers in their different countries. There are inexpensive Chinese cars for sale in Germany, also in the United Kingdom. BYD is selling a car called a Seagull for about an $11,500 in Germany. It's an EV that's undercutting German cars. And then its $33,000 Dolphin is one of the cheapest new cars in the United Kingdom.
And people need to understand they're not doing that out of the goodness of their heart. They're doing that to completely undercut the domestic manufacturers and other nations' manufacturers and to cause them to lose market share and then take over the market, right?
Yes. Well, there's nothing wrong with the profit motive as long as it's reciprocal. But China subsidizes energy, labor, and capital, so artificially making its costs lower than European and Western manufacturers. So American and European manufacturers have to keep to certain standards of energy production, whereas China is building two coal-fired power plants a week and has much less expensive energy. It has less expensive labor costs. First of all, because wages are lower. Second, because it uses child labor to get minerals for batteries and slave labor in Xinjiang. And third, the Chinese Communist Party gives its favored companies low interest loans. So the cost structure is much lower in China than in the United States and in Western Europe. Plus, all these subsidies from the Chinese Communist Party just render prices much lower. In addition, there isn't any reciprocity. So a Chinese company can set up in the United States and own 100% of that company. But if an American company sets up in China, the Chinese government, in other words, the Communist Party, has to have a share. an American company cannot have a standalone company in China. The government always has a share of that. So there isn't any reciprocity. For example, TikTok can be here in the United States, but American companies can't have their social media companies in China.
That's precisely correct. And that whole reciprocity issue is pervasive when you're talking about China in any element of the economy.
Yes. I mean, another element of the economy is that Chinese companies can list on American stock markets and raise capital here in the United States, but American companies cannot list on Chinese stock markets and raise capital there.
And of course, there's been a push within the American market to shift to EVs, not just on consumer EVs, but also trucking EVs, which raises a whole new set of concerns. And those guidelines and timelines are being set by the federal government in some states, such as California. Are these realistic goals more of a myth or a fantasy?
Well, the Energy Department, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the Department of Transportation want 60% of new vehicle sales to be electric by 2030 and 66% to be electric by 2032. That means of all the new cars sold in the United States, by 2032, two-thirds would be electric, according to proposed rules put out by the Transportation Department and EPA last fall. The administration is about to bring out final rules, and the final rules sent over by those agencies to the White House were apparently very similar to the proposed rules. But the news articles that we're reading today say that now the White House is reconsidering, that they are admitting that they cannot sell this volume of electric vehicles by 2030. And they are making the targets a lot easier. We're in an election year right now. I believe something's going to be happening in November. And maybe the White House is thinking it's not a great idea to be taking away people's gasoline-powered cars right before an election. Doesn't look too good, especially in the big area between California and New York State, where people depend on Ford F-150 pickup trucks for their work. Farmers need them for agriculture, and small businesses use them every day.
And I'd like to circle back to the issues involved with rare earth mining that is essential to EV manufacturing and battery manufacturing. And the fact that most of these materials are sourced primarily from the PRC, what are some potential solutions to that issue?
Well, there are a lot of sources of rare earth mining and minerals. There's some in the People's Republic of China. There's also a lot in Latin America and Africa. And what we're seeing is that China is buying up a lot of those critical minerals abroad, as well as having control of those within its own borders. For example, the Democratic Republic of the Congo has a large share of cobalt, and China owns a lot of those mines. It used to be that China had about 80% of critical minerals. Now that's gone down to about 60% of global critical minerals, but that's still well over half. And then China uses those minerals in the processing of many electronic components, and in the processing of its batteries. Mark Mills of the Manhattan Institute has estimated that 500,000 pounds of earth needs to be moved to get the critical minerals for one electric battery. So going electric is not necessarily a recipe for a good environment. Masses and masses of earth and mines have to be constructed, and President Biden doesn't want to do it here in the United States. We have a lot of minerals here in the United States, but there are restrictions on mining, and some mines that contain these critical minerals have been closed by the Biden administration.
And do we have the electrical infrastructure in a macro sense with our current electrical grid, and also in a micro sense in home wiring and capacity to facilitate wholesale EV charging by American consumers?
That's a great question, Charlton. And as we've seen from the recent events in Chicago, where not only the batteries lost power due to the extreme cold, but also the charging stations froze, in the winter, we definitely do not have that capacity. And last summer, right after Governor Gavin Newsom in California said that all vehicle sales had to be electric in 2035. The next week he said, please don't charge your EVs at night because we don't have enough power. The truth is, Charlton, that our electric grid can barely manage as it is. We have blackouts, more blackouts than we want. And there's no way that we can have that many electrical vehicles on the grid and still keep up our capacity without blackouts, especially since the Environmental Protection Agency has another set of rules, power plant rules, requiring power plants to sequester, that means bury, 90% of their carbon emissions by 2039. Otherwise, they have to close the power plant down in 2040. So just as all these EVs, if the administration has forecast correctly, will be going online, then power plants would be closing because they cannot meet the EPA's requirements. Right now, about 7% of cars purchased are pure battery-powered electric, and I'm all in favor of anyone who wants an electric car to be able to buy one. I just don't see why people should be forced to buy one, because there are many people who don't want to pay the extra cost on long trips. They don't want to wait 1 or 2 hours to recharge every couple of hundred miles. They don't work in cold climates, and we don't want to be dependent on China.
Diana, that is a fantastic point, especially when one considers much of our electrical capacity and production comes from fossil fuels. And without a genuine commitment to creating new resources from nuclear power and such, it is a considerable conundrum for the push toward EVs.
It really is. And if we had all nuclear power, or even 60% of our energy generated by nuclear power the way France does, then our electric vehicles might really be emissions-free. But we have a smaller share of nuclear power, about 20%. And so additional power for the EVs is generated by natural gas and coal, so they're not emissions-free. Some of them might not even be lower emissions. What's really flying off the dealer lots, Charlton, are the non-plug-in hybrids with a slightly larger battery that extends the gas mileage. And Toyota, in particular, has been tremendously successful with these vehicles. Some people now only want to buy the minivans with the extra large battery, the non-plug-in hybrid, because that means they get a lot better gas mileage. And Toyota was one of the first companies to institute this with the Prius, and it's taken off in larger vehicles too. There's a huge advantage in getting better gas mileage without having to plug in your vehicle. Because think of all those people who live in apartments who cannot plug in and charge their vehicles overnight and have to rely on these outdoor charging stations. It's really inconvenient for them. But if they have a non-plug-in hybrid, they can get the advantages of that extra battery power, which is charged through the operation of the engine and the operation of the braking system, without the inconvenience of having to go to a Walmart or a state charging station to actually plug in, wait an hour or two until the vehicle recharges.
I wanted to circle back for a minute about the potential for Chinese EVs to collect and send back a trove of Americans' personal data. We know that that is happening with TikTok, yet there's still a considerable publicity effort by TikTok to re-educate Americans and make it seem innocuous. What are some of the things that we need to do and we need to know to try to make sure the American citizenry understands that overall, this is a very bad development in terms of American security for one of our leading, if not our leading competitor in the global security sphere to be collecting personal information, whether through TikTok or electric vehicles?
Well, I think it's very important to know that the car is capable of collecting this information and where the information goes. It's one thing to have it go to an American car company, another thing to have it go to the Chinese Communist Party. Think about it. If the car can send back telematics and an EV is just a big computer on wheels, it sends back where you commute, it can pick up signals from military bases, from power plants, from utility companies. Also, if you get a loan to buy the car, which you might because they are not inexpensive, you have to give your credit rating. That means access to your different kinds of credit cards, your social security number, your driver's license, your mortgage, your banking information. So all of this is information that the Chinese Communist Party would have. In Charleston, I think it's important that people should know that companies in China are all part of the Chinese Communist Party. It's like one big family. There's some control that the party exerts over these major companies. They don't operate by themselves in a vacuum the way some companies in the United States do. So by giving your information to BYD or Great Wall, you're also giving it to the Chinese Communist Party.
Is there anything else we need to know about this issue? And also, what are your key takeaways for our listeners?
I think it's also important to know that the Inflation Reduction Act contained over $1 trillion in clean energy initiatives to fund American EVs and domestic battery manufacturing plants. And that if we have Chinese EVs undercutting the domestic industry, that goes against congressional intent. It means the $1 trillion in tax credits are basically wasted because the domestic industry that Congress envisaged is not being set up because people would just turn around and buy the less expensive Chinese models. So we might as well just get rid of the Inflation Reduction Act tax credits as it is. And one way, I believe, to keep out the Chinese EVs is to say that it's contrary to congressional intent. Another important takeaway for our listeners, Charlton, is that China is proposing plants in Mexico to bring these cars in tariff-free through the new North American Trade Agreement. So vehicles made in Mexico for Chinese companies would be eligible just to come into the United States. So it's not enough to ban Chinese EVs made in China. We also need to ban Chinese EVs made in Mexico and Canada as part of the free trade agreement between these three countries.
That's a very good point. Diana, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
The Modern Federalist, hosted by Charlton Allen, will return in a moment.
This segment, I wanted to dive headfirst into that enigma that is the DC Purple Line. There's a twist. We have an insightful piece from Mark Jaffe at the Cato Institute to spice things up. You'll find it in the show notes. So grab your metaphorical metro tickets, settle into your mental train carriages, and let's embark on this rail-bound adventure. Ah, the Purple Line, Maryland's ambitious light rail project, has been quite the enigma since 2022. It's like that elusive friend who can't commit to plans, always leaving us with a, maybe next year. Let's dive into the saga of this rail line that's been playing oh so hard to get. First, there's the completion date drama. The latest update is that the Purple Line has been delayed to winter 2027. Yes, you heard that right. We're now officially entering the era of it's coming when it's coming. Perhaps it's secretly moonlighting as a procrastinator. Then there's the budget roller coaster. Originally, the state of Maryland agreed to pay $5.6 billion for construction and operation of the extension over 30 years. But hold your tickets. The cost overrun party is now in full swing, and the tab has skyrocketed to a cool $9.3 billion. At this rate, we might just pave the tracks with dollar bills. And now for the progress report. Fear not, fellow travelers, the Purple Line is 65% complete, which in infrastructure terms translates to we've still got plenty of coffee breaks ahead. With 13 out of 21 stations actively under construction, we're inching our way toward the finish line, literally. Is it worth the wait? Will the Purple Line be worth it? Well, only time will tell. But one thing's certain, it's giving us plenty to talk about. So keep those rail tickets handy and your schedules, well, open-ended. Finally, we will continue to update the progress or lack thereof for the Purple Line and ask the question, will it be completed before flying cars become mainstream? Spoiler alert, it's a close race between rails and wings. And the smart money's on George Jetson. And remember, in the world of public transit, it's not just about the destination. It's about the journey and the endless construction detours along the way.
Of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the world, she walks into mine, listening to the Modern Federalist. Now that's a dame with taste. This is Charlton Allen's world. We're just living in it.
The Modern Federalist podcast, hosted by Charlton Allen. Find us today where you get your podcasts.
Ladies and gentlemen, as we draw the curtain on this episode, let us stand on the precipice of conviction. Our esteemed guest, Diana Furtgott-Roth of the Heritage Foundation, has illuminated our path with insights that echo through the corridors of liberty. Diana's unwavering leadership on national energy and climate issues is a beacon, a lighthouse cutting through the fog of uncertainty. But today, we steer toward a specific reef, the question of banning Chinese-made EVs. Here's our adjusted course. Imagine our grandchildren, their eyes wide as they step into a world shaped by our choices. Will they inherit innovation or dependency? Diana reminds us this duty transcends politics. It's a sacred pact with generations yet unborn. Banning Chinese EVs isn't about tariffs. It's about our legacy. It's about our freedom. It's about our way of life. As we grapple with the great tragedy of Baltimore, let us pause. The evidence is not yet in, but regardless of the cause, our citizens must awaken. There are bad actors in this world, those who wish us and our society great harm. Even if the bridge collapse was accidental, these enemies watch, take notes, and plot. We are a beacon of liberty, an outlier in a world where tyranny often masquerades as virtue. Historically, we've stood against the norm, our banner unfurling over the land of the free, the home of the brave. But beware, my friends. Those with darkness in their hearts see us as the enemy. They watch, they wait, they slink into dark corners, and they test our resolve. Our response? Clear-eyed and steady. We don't flinch. We don't falter. This week, I've pondered Fort McHenry, the sentinel in Baltimore's harbor. There our flag endured the storm, as stars and stripes defiant against the tempest. When we rise again in the morn, may we find our banner still flying high. Our nation, too, faces storms, some natural, some man-made, but our resolve, unyielding, our faith, unshaken. For we are the descendants of those who held the line, inked the Constitution, and dared to dream of a more perfect union. As this episode concludes, in this high holy time across faith traditions, may peace and goodwill envelop you. And so, my fellow seekers of truth, until next we gather, keep your eyes on the horizon. Our banner flutters, stitched with hope and resilience. May it ever fly over the land of the free and the home of the brave. This has been the Modern Federalist Podcast, a symphony of ideas, a refuge for patriots. Until next we meet, stay vigilant, stay informed, and may the winds of liberty ever fill your sails. Until next time, this is Charlton Allen. Signing off for now.
Thanks for tuning in to The Modern Federalist. Don't forget to subscribe for more thought-provoking episodes. Until next time.